Hello, it's Wednesday, January the 27th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Daily Show coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, we're going to give you the best price advice to tie in with Mailforce's campaign to ensure all primary age children have access to a computer or tablet, and also the way to access the internet most cheaply and economically. Primary schools. The Prime Minister said at the Downing Street briefing on Tuesday night, big hint, they're going to open after the February half term. Oh dear, by Wednesday morning, that's not looking so sure. I'm going to be talking to a mum who's struggling with home tuition. But first, that grim figure, 100,000 deaths from coronavirus, the worst in Europe. I'm going to be talking to a professor about, did we get things wrong? And if we did, are we now putting them right? It was a long time coming, but finally the United Kingdom has hit the somber milestone, the first in Europe, of 100,000 deaths as a result of COVID-19. The Prime Minister says he takes full responsibility for every action his government has taken in the pandemic. Has the government's approach to protecting us from the virus been the right one? And are they pursuing the right strategy now? Joining me to discuss this is Mark Walhouse, who's Professor of Infectious Disease Epidemiology at the University of Edinburgh. So the Prime Minister, Professor, maintains the government did its best. It did the right things with the pandemic. Is he right? And are they continuing to do the right things, or are they still getting things wrong?
So we clearly didn't do all the right things. We've had 100,000 deaths, one of the worst death tolls per capita in the world. Mistakes were made and lessons are going to have to be learned. As you quite rightly say, they're going to have to be learned quickly because we still are in the middle of this epidemic. We have to manage the number of cases, hospitalizations and deaths going forward. So it's important that we get it right from here on.
The mistakes that were made, they've been pretty well discussed. Slow into lockdown. We didn't close down airports. Flights were still coming in. And even today, we've seen a divergence between England and Scotland. In England, they're going to ban flights from countries which are regarded as a problem, such as Brazil and South Africa. We think in Scotland, they are probably going to ban all flights.
Yes, there's been a lot of unclear thinking about the role of travel restrictions and banning flights on this epidemic. The time to do that was very early on indeed, back in February or even the end of January, when there was some chance of stopping the infection arriving in the UK and becoming established here. Once it's established, the role of flight bans is actually quite marginal. And whatever measures are announced today, we won't see a short-term benefit from that in terms of the epidemic curve in the UK. Incoming infections just make too small a contribution to the epidemic. There are other reasons to consider travel bans to do with new variants and so on, and those may have longer term benefits, but of course they will come at great cost as well.
Professor Chris Whitty said in the Downing Street briefing last night, Professor, that the scientists were too slow to pick up on the significance of masks, but we know the World Health Organization changed its mind on masks in the middle of the summer. And also they were not alert enough to the danger of the number of people who had COVID but were not showing any symptoms. Were they very serious errors in hindsight?
Yes, I'm not sure that I would call those errors at all. There was recognition that there was asymptomatic transmission of this virus from very early on, although I have to say the Chinese authorities were quite resistant to this idea, but the evidence was clear, and that was one of the reasons why the virus became so well established in the UK in February, in that a lot of these infections were in young, healthy adults, and they simply weren't showing up as serious symptoms, so they weren't being reported. So I don't think you can call that a particular mistake. The one big mistake that people have alluded to many times is the failure to recognize the threat to care homes. And that was apparent, but it took a long time for the government to accept that this infection is particularly deadly for the elderly and the frail. If you remember, back in March, they were telling us that we're all at risk. This virus doesn't discriminate. Well, I'm afraid that was just wrong. The virus discriminates greatly, and it discriminates against the elderly and the frail. And if we don't recognize who's most at risk from this virus, how can we possibly do our best to protect the people who need protecting?
Glad you raised that point, because on that point, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a doctor, Professor, but it would have been obvious to me, I would have thought, that the most vulnerable people are those who are indoors the whole time, not getting out very much, living cheek by jowl with each other, who are very old and possibly having underlying health symptoms.
Well, I agree with you, but it did take a long time for the public health authorities and government, and indeed some government scientists, to recognise where the risk from this virus most lay, and you've characterised it very well. If we'd done more earlier to protect people in those situations, one of the key ways we do that, by the way, is not by doing what the government tried to do, which, remember, was to shield people, which essentially translated into not having any contacts at all, which is neither sustainable nor desirable for many people. No one can live like that for an extended period of time. So what we need to do is make their contacts safe. And the way we do that is particularly by testing the people around the elderly and the frail, the carers, the care home workers, the house visitors, and so on. And that will decrease the risk to them. It will make them safer, it will reduce the burden on the NHS, and a lot of lives would have been saved if we'd been serious about taking those sorts of measures from the outset.
Finally, Professor, it was pretty clear from what was said at the Downing Street briefing that the death toll is going to continue to mount. There's always a lag between the lockdown and the hospital admissions and fatalities. I'm not going to ask you to speculate where the death toll will end up, but are you confident now the government will have learnt lessons from the experience of the last 9, 10, 11 months, call it what you will, and that they are in a better position now to protect the public from this wretched disease?
No, I'm not. The epidemic is starting to turn around, but it is still true that many of the people who are going to die during the second wave have not yet been infected. In other words, those infections can still be prevented. They can't be prevented by further lockdown. We played that card. We've done our best to suppress the virus in the community and reduce the R number. What we need now is to supplement that by taking extra precautions to protect the people who, if they do get this infection, are likely to end up in hospital or possibly die. We haven't learned that lesson yet, and every time we mention protecting the vulnerable, it seems to be like an afterthought. It seems to be this is something you only do once you've gone into lockdown. It's something we should have been doing all the time over the last 12 months, and if we'd done it better, an awful lot of lives would have been saved.
Well, that's a sobering thought. That's Professor Mark Woolhouse. Mark Woolhouse, he's Professor of Infectious Disease Epidemiology at the University of Edinburgh. So in that same press conference last night, the Prime Minister gave a hint, which I think most parents will be thrilled to have heard, that primary schools at least could be allowed to open to pupils after the February half term. But he's rolled back on the suggestion today, saying he's hopeful schools may be able to open from the start of March, which is not so good for parents struggling with home teaching. Amelia Terode is one of the many parents juggling homeschooling with working from home, and she's part of the Fawn Break Collective and joins me now. Amelia, now you did a tweet about homeschooling that went viral. What did it say?
I think I had probably hit my low point. It was last week and it was also my birthday. And I woke up, our Wi-Fi was broken, the printer wasn't working, the kids had live lessons, and I kind of lost it. It just really, really, really made me realize that it's impossible task for working parents. And I think specifically working parents with primary school age kids, it's just impossible to sit down and do work when you've got little ones whose printer doesn't work, the Wi-Fi doesn't work, they've got questions, they're hungry, they need to go to the loo, they're bored, they're lonely, they've got a million other things to do. And the thing that just fails to be done, I think, from a parental perspective, is actually get your day job done.
So you expressed your exasperation and frustration in that tweet, did you?
I did. I just didn't know who to talk to or what to do, and it seemed to have hit a nerve with working parents across the UK and beyond. So I had 4,000 people get back in touch with me, sharing their stories, the kind of the pain and the horror for the kids and for the parents.
Now, you're a parent working from home. As you know, Amelia, it often falls on the mother rather than the father. And what age are your children who you're helping to teach?
So I've got two boys. I've got Eugene, who is 9, which means he's in year 4, and yeah. Felix, who is 10, and he's in year 6. So that's the last year of primary school.
And so they're at different stages. Did they both have the right computer equipment? Are you getting sufficient support from the school with online lessons and tuition, or are you having to do it yourself?
So it's really hard. I think this has been the real eye-opener. The kids are both at state schools, a great little state school down in South London. But what's been kind of eye-opening is I always got the difference between state, provision and primary. But the thing that's been really kind of just disheartening to see is the difference between state and state. So, you know, we've got one kid who's got one live lesson a week, but on his class, there are 45 children in a class. So actually, it's live, but the chat's disabled. They're sitting there. They're not supposed to talk to each other. And there are 45 children, and that's once a week. The other son has got one live lesson a day, but that's compared to other kids who are kind of the whole schools have pivoted and moved everything online. So just the differences in the experience of what exactly remote learning is just so vastly different from school to school and from region to region.
What do you want to happen next? Because clearly you're not going to get your children back to school anytime before half term in February, and it could be even later. I mean, you were at the end of your tether last week. You had technical hitches. That could all happen again. What do you want now the government to do to make your life even slightly more tolerable?
This is definitely not a teacher bashing thing. So we've got teachers on my side of the family and my husband's as well, and teachers are doing the best job they could possibly do. I think what needs to happen is some degree of standardisation. So what exactly should parents be expecting from schools? So according to Ofsted, primary school age children should be getting the equivalent of 4 hours worth of lessons a day. But certainly that's not our experience, and that doesn't seem to be the experience of other people that we know. So I guess what would be really helpful would be help for parents to understand how much they're supposed to do, how much schools are supposed to provide to you. And also, I mean, this is my big thing, which is, you know, I worry that we will get to the end of this term and I don't think they'll go back. My worry is that maybe they will split the classes. I've got, you know, my children are in a class with 31, 32 children. So I'm guessing that most state schools, the only option in the summer will be to divide the classes in half, 1 week on, 1 week off. And I just think they're going to end up in September. I have no idea how far behind they're going to be. You know, there's been a lot of chat online about, you know, the kids just need to redo this year. Do we kind of just write off the fact that actually there's been substandard teaching that actually it's not fair to the kids? These are kind of foundation stones. I've got, you know, Felix is heading into secondary school in September. I don't know if he's even got all the kind of building blocks in place when he starts at secondary school.
There are some people who are arguing, aren't there, Amelia, that actually a year should be just lopped off the school calendar and you almost start again, so that when the September term starts, it's as if it's from the year before.
From my perspective, I actually think that's quite a sensible idea, because, I mean, we know what it's like. You know, education's layered, isn't it? Every year builds on the layer before. And actually, if you don't have those building blocks in place, all you're doing is kind of postponing a kind of educational crisis. So from my perspective, actually restarting seems really sensible. I have no idea logistically. Again, I'm not a teacher, but I do worry. I look at the discrepancy and the levels of learning and understanding, even within just my own kids' year groups. It's astonishing. It really is astonishing. And I have no idea how the teachers are going to be able to teach next year.
Who would be a teacher?
And that's the thing, because actually, if you know, there's that wonderful old advert, you know, you never forget a great teacher. And actually, great teachers inspire and engage and make you look at the world with kind of curiosity and hope. And you know, they encourage and they provoke and they challenge. And at the moment, you know, I kind of listen in and it's really boring. You know, it's that they're desperately trying to bring everybody up to the same level. But there isn't much excitement. There isn't much. How can you kind of sparkle as a teacher when you've got 45 kids, some with Wi-Fi, some with video cameras turned on, you know, some with video cameras turned off? It's an impossible task. And I guess what's really sad is, I think, you know, I know there's no other way to do it, but I think there's a generation of kids that they're just bored. You know, they're sitting there in front of their screens trying to do worksheets and kind of, you know, doing the best that they can do, and the teachers are doing the best that they can do, but it's, you know, it's definitely not ideal.
Certainly, I don't envy you at all. That's Amelia Terode, mother of two boys, aged 9 and 10, doing the homeschooling. Very best of luck to you. So the Mailforce's campaign to ensure that all primary age school children have access to a computer or tablet for homeschooling has had a flying start. Already, the total money raised is over £1.3 million. But it's not just the hardware that's causing difficulties for some struggling families, with some reports one in three families don't have a proper computer or tablet, but it's also the cost of accessing the internet itself, which is preventing some people from getting online. So Moneymail's chief reporter Amelia Murray has rounded up some of the best deals available to parents, and she joins me now. Amelia, you've struck on a chord here, haven't you? Because we know it's not just computers that parents are struggling with. It's useless broadband access, and also sometimes far too expensive broadband access.
Absolutely. And I think what's really important to say here is, you know, broadband, I mean, you're probably the same as me, but I remember a life without internet. I remember when it was, you know, we got it in the home when I was sort of a teenager. And since then, it, you know, that was a luxury. I used to sort of chat to my friends on MSN. It wasn't really necessary for schoolwork. But since then, it's gone from being a luxury to an absolute necessity. And what we've seen from lockdown, when, you know, people are having to work and learn from school, is just how important and, you know, and crucial it is to families. What we've got is, you know, almost a million children don't have access to broadband. And as you kind of mentioned before, there's like the issue with hardware. So, you know, a study from a comparison site YouthWitch suggested that a quarter of primary school kids have to share their laptop with their siblings during the day. And a third of older children in secondary school, so studying for GCSEs, don't have full-time access to a laptop either. And as you mentioned as well, the issue with connection, there's like a third of parents who said they struggle with broadband and their connection with so many people using it at the same time. And I don't know if you remember, but back in the summer, we were talking about broadband as well, when people were suddenly realizing that their connection was not strong enough to support everyone working from home, as well as the kids. So it's been a problem for a while, but perhaps was not foreseen before the pandemic. And I guess what's come from the work that I did on this story is, you know, what is being provided. Which, I don't know, would you like me to carry on, or have you got questions?
Yeah, no, do. Tell us what's out there, how much it's costing, and where are the best deals?
Yes, so, I mean, mobile data, which, you know, you may think you can't really do your homeschooling from a smartphone, which is probably right, but what you can do is you can tether your mobile data to your computer. It's called hotspotting, which sounds like the kind of nightclub I'd like to go to. And you can use it on the computer. So what a number of mobile providers have done is they've teamed up with the Department of Education as part of its Get Help with Technology scheme, and they are offering mobile data upgrades to disadvantaged children. A number of providers have signed up, mainly like the big ones. So you've got O2, BT Mobile, EE, 3, Sky Mobile, Plusnet Mobile, Vodafone as well. And Virgin Mobile. And you need to basically make the application through your school. The Department of Education has told me it doesn't ask for proof of which children would be eligible. It's based on, you know, what the school has decided. There are criteria. It's only available to kids in years 3 to 11. They must be working, being homeschooled as a result of the pandemic. They must not have a fixed broadband connection, and their parents are unable to afford to top up their mobile data. And so that's all for, you know, the school to kind of put forward the children.
Is it the school would then put the children forward for this, or do the parents do it themselves?
No, so for parents who think their children are eligible, they need to kind of have the conversation with the school. They can't apply directly for the data themselves. It also depends on which provider you're with. So for example, you know, O2 and Virgin, and the amount of data that you will get depends on who you're a customer with, but it's all in the article. So for example, you know, some firms are offering unlimited data till the end of the academic year, whereas others, such as Sky, is offering 100 gigabytes as a one-off data upgrade.
And how long and how significant would that be, 100 gigabytes upgrade? What does that mean in layman's terms, Amelia?
So that's a generous amount of data. So, for example, a gigabyte is a measurement of the data that you use. Put it into practice, an hour of sort of general web browsing would use between 10 and 25 megabytes.
Okay, yeah.
Whereas 30 minutes of streaming YouTube is around 175 megabytes. So if your brain is in good nick to understand this, there's 1,000 megabytes in a gigabyte, which, and I mean, it should be plenty.
Well, it's a great scheme. Are many people aware of it? That's the problem, Amelia. I mean, of course, Money Mail is highlighting it today. But are many people aware of it, do you think? Are the government shouting out about it loud enough?
Well, this is it. I mean, you'd like to think that the schools were kind of doing what they can to promote it. And, you know, I haven't seen much about it in the press. I asked the Department of Education yesterday for numbers, and they weren't giving them to me or kind of announcing them. But in the meantime, there are also other things. I mean, if you don't qualify for these schemes, there are a number of other things that I have also listed in the article. So, for example, vulnerable customers on Virgin Mobile can request an extra 500 minutes, 500 text messages, and an extra gig of data every month. That's for people on Universal Credit. BT is doing, it's also giving out Wi-Fi vouchers to schools and charity partners that will allow children to connect to one of 5 million Wi-Fi hotspots, although this is only going to sort of cover 20 to 30% of homes. The Department of Education is also offering free 4G wireless routers to disadvantaged children, which will also provide the same connection as your smartphone if people don't have the connections in their house already.
Well, it sounds fascinating. Read all about it in Money Mail today. That's Money Mail's chief reporter, Amelia Murray. And if you are one of those parents who's struggling to get your child online, this could be the answer to your problem. So do have a good read today. Matt Gatwood, Deputy Sports Editor of the Daily Mail, joins me now with all the latest news from the world of sport, which, of course, I know so little about. But I know Chelsea's got yet another manager. I've never heard of him, Matt, obviously. So who is he? Because obviously it's a he. No, she's obviously managing football clubs in the Premier League yet.
No, sadly. And that day will come, I hope. But at the moment...
Probably not in my lifetime.
Well, yeah, maybe not. This is Thomas Tuchel, who is a German guy who was in charge of Paris Saint-Germain up until about a month ago when he was sacked from there. He took PSG to the Champions League final last season, where they lost to Bayern Munich. So he's got, you know, decent track record. Before that, he was coaching in Germany, where he did very well as well with Borussia Dortmund. So he's very different to Lampard. He was no great player, just always been interested in coaching from a very young age. I think he got an injury when he was reasonably young, so turned to coaching. He's a kind of football obsessive, he's been described as a sort of football nerd. He's into furniture design in his spare time. He's got an economics diploma, so he's not your sort of traditional football coach. So he's going to be interesting. You know, he's a very intelligent chap, and he takes his first game this evening when he'll be in charge. He'll be in charge when Chelsea play Wolves this evening. So he had them training last night at 6 p.m. in the dark, so he's already sort of shaking things up and getting them working and changing the routine. So it's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting to see how he gets on.
Two questions, Matt. How much are they paying him? Do we know? What's his salary? I need my eyes to be watered here. And if he's such a good manager, why did Paris Saint-Germain sack him?
He's not the easiest of characters. So he has had fallings out with those in positions of power. So, you know, how he's going to get on with the hierarchy at Chelsea remains to be seen. You've got, you know, some strong characters at the club, obviously Roman Abramovich being the owner. He's not always the easiest person to sort of get on with if you look at his track record. So the sporting director at PSG, the Brazilian guy called Leonardo, and they had plenty of run-ins. There does tend to be maybe a cycle with these things. They felt like he'd maybe taken the club as far as he could. He got into the Champions League final, they lost. He'd had three seasons before that where they'd won the league every time, but then PSG, you know, you could take PSG to the title in in France. So
I doubt I could.
He just fell short of the Champions League. But yeah, I mean, you know, why didn't they keep him on? I think largely because he had a few run-ins with a few of the players. They obviously have superstar players there like Neymar and Mbappe. And he had a few run-ins with the staff. In terms of his wages, I don't know what he's on, but he's only on an 18-month contract, which is unusual for a top manager to take such a short contract. Normally they want 3-4 years, you know, whether he goes beyond 18 months. As Chelsea manager, one would doubt that's about the shelf life of the Chelsea boss, so it's probably enough.
All right, and of course then Manchester City have gone back to the top of the Premier League, apparently for the first time in 18 months, Matt.
The first time this season, yeah, that they've been top of the league overnight, as in, you know, they went top for a couple of hours till Man U overtook them again last week. But yeah, first time they've been top of the league. So they hammered West Brom last night, 5-0, and they're on this incredible run of form. And yeah, they've gone to the top. So, you know, they're obviously now have become the bookies' favourites to win the league, despite the fact that we've been talking about Manchester United, Liverpool, Tottenham, Leicester, all these clubs. In fact, there's been about 7 clubs now this season who've spent a night on top of the league. Even if you go back, as you know, the first day of the season, it was Arsenal, but that seems like a very long time ago. But yeah, Man City are there now, overnight last night. So we'll see how they go. But they're in great form. They've just lost a couple of players through injury. One of them, their star player, Kevin De Bruyne. So it'd be interesting to see if they can cope with his absence.
And Matt, just finally, England have defended the decision to send players home. Is that the cricket team?
Yeah, the cricket team. So we talked before about the fact they've got so many test matches this year. They've got 17 test matches to play. And rather than make all the players play all of these tests, they're going to send a couple home. So they've sent Johnny Bairstow, who is one of the stars of the series victory over Sri Lanka. He's now going home rather than going to India, where England start 4 tests next week. And they just think, England just think that there's no way they can expect anyone to do all of these tests, living in these bubbles like they have to do, and stay sane. So, but that's been criticised in some quarters for who they're sending home, how long they're going home for, and a lot of the criticism surrounds the IPL, the Indian Premier League, because a lot of these players who are being sent home to rest will then go and pick up some fairly fat paychecks playing in the IPL for 4, 5, 6 weeks. And that's been frowned upon by certain England cricket fans who think, well, shouldn't they use that 6-week period to rest rather than pick up a pay packet? And that's the argument.
That's Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood with the latest from the world of sport. Thanks for joining us. So January is the time to try new things, new hobby, exercise regime, new diet, give up the booze like me, and it's driving me mad, or perhaps even give up meat. Now, some meat eaters say they've been guilt-tripped this January into trying not just vegetarianism, but going the whole hog and going vegan. Half of us who've been surveyed said we were pressurised into cutting meat during vegan January due to pressure from partners, parents and friends. But is it healthy to give in to peer pressure on your diet? Somebody we all know is the leading food psychologist, Greg Tucker, who joins me now. So, Greg, what do you say? Should we give in to this sort of pressure? Is it blackmail, or is it doing us a bit of good if we do agree to try to go vegan?
I wouldn't call it blackmail, but your relationship with food is like your relationship with your partner and your children. It's a relationship. And the emotions are what matters. So it's not so much whether you're giving in to pressure, it's whether you are taking a positive mood spin out of this and seeing that veganuary is a way to actually regain some control over your diet and what you're eating. And that's what the survey is showing us. Not only that people feel they're under pressure, but they're finding ways to actually manage the whole of the challenge of veganuary to get themselves through the month.
And do you think it's caught on this year more than any other year? And if so, is that because of lockdown? People want to try something different?
Unfortunately, there is no single answer to that question. Of course, there is a lockdown effect, but people are also becoming more aware of some of the issues around meat. But then again, they want some help in actually managing to reduce their meat consumption. And that's what we found with this work that we did with Jack Links, where we did some surveys of what's actually happening and discovered it's not quite as simple as saying people are doing veganuary, but what's actually happening is that up to 10% of people who are doing that are actually buying cured meats, for example, to sniff them. They want to still have
some. Oh, my God.
Exactly, to have that meat fix. And other people are finding that the way to do this is not to go all in and give up with all meat entirely, but just to make a commitment to having no meat at meal times, for example, and instead having things like biltong and jerky, beef jerky protein snacks, so that you can have a snack maybe once or twice a week, as a way to say, I'm not going completely without meat. I'm not having it at meal times, so I'm following a veganuary kind of regime, but I'm still getting my meat fix, which means that I can keep going all the way to the end of the month.
People really do sniff cured meats to get their fix?
That's how much people are missing the meat actually normally used to having. You would be surprised, but actually some people do really love meat. And there's one way of being guaranteed to make people fixate over something is to say they can't have it. So the answer is not to go complete, apologies for the pun, cold turkey, but to actually say, yeah, I can have some meat, but I can manage how I'm going to have it as a snack occasionally, rather than an assumption I have it at every meal.
So those people who've made that the sort of sacrifice this month, Greg, they may have done it to keep their partner happy. We see in the research with Jack Links, there's a lot of that. It's pressure from a partner or a parent. Are they then on February the 1st going to tuck into a big, fat, red meat steak so they can get back to normal? Or are they going to stay where they were?
Look, there's no black and white answer to that. You're going to actually have some people who will go for an enormous pig out and have a, you know, literally, metaphorically a pig out. They'll go full in on the meat. Other people will just say, you know what? I now realize I don't have to have meat at every meal time. So there's a spectrum of responses. But some people will have been so fixated on going completely without that they will then go switch back to saying, I'm never doing that again. And it's those waverers, those people who are perhaps struggling, for which protein snacks and things like jerky can actually help, because they can help bridge the gap between none and all in. They allow you to have some, but in a managed way, but to break that assumption of meat at every meal.
Do some people come to see you, Greg, because they are so hooked on meat and they want someone like you, a psychologist, a food psychologist no less, to try to wean them off their habit?
Absolutely. People need help with their relationship with food in all sorts of ways. And it's important that people actually understand that every culture in the world has breaking bread, sharing food together as one of those basic human interactions. And it's one of those things that we derive pleasure and enjoyment from. And it's rebalancing that relationship that matters, whether it be with snacks or with carbohydrates, whether it be with meat or with booze or whatever it might be. What we're trying to do is to help people understand that there's an emotional takeout from their relationship with food and manage the mood takeout, the interaction with it, so that it becomes a partner and a friend and no longer something to be fought against. Because when you actually have antipathy in the relationship and animosity and people fearing what food means for them, then they get into despair, they get into that negative cycle. And what we try and do is to find the positive in it. It's not about all or nothing. It's about managing a balance.
How much meat do you eat?
Less than I used to.
Right.
We try and alternate during the week between meeting meals and no meat at all. And we find that works brilliantly. It's not about going all or nothing. But again, maybe I'm not the right person to ask, because I kind of find it easy to understand my relationship with food because it's what I do all day, every day. But I think it's one of those things where the game isn't written in stone. So we can change as we grow and as we move on and as we learn more about ourselves and more about food. And to be honest, there's more choice than there ever was. Plant-based alternatives.
Yeah.
There's plenty of things out there now.
All right, that's the food psychologist Greg Tucker talking about veganary pressure.
That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Daily Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.